Can Donald Trump truly reverse the trends of inflation and high costs with tariffs and drill, baby, drill? Is the United States now repeating the same tariff pattern that precipitated the Great Depression? What does the selection of his cabinet positions tell us about the direction of U.S. policy toward Israel? Is a third world war now in the works in this new age of Trump? This week on the Global Research News Hour, with the return of President Trump to high power, what can we now expect from this presidential felon with his bold and occasionally inaccurate assertions, especially having learned from his first time out what is on the drawing board for the USA and what the stakes are for the more vulnerable people on the planet? In our first half hour, we speak to Quebec international economist Professor Rodrigue Tremblay about Trump's economic agenda, particularly the tariff agenda, and how it's likely to impact the world. Then in our second half hour, we talk to independent researcher and writer Timothy Alexander Guzman about the Trump cabinet picks and what it says about the future of American foreign policy. On this week's program, Trump 2, the Wrath of MAGA, Dawn of the Billionaire Class, Dusk of the Rest of Us. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of January 24th, 2025. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are available to partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.com. We acknowledge that this program was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The settlers from Europe used unfair and unjust efforts to extract the benefits of the land from the indigenous population. Their descendants must recognize the horrible cost of this bounty in human terms and work toward reconciliation and reparations before equality and a respectful partnership can be achieved. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. COVID policies served as a pretext for halting economic activity in a controlled manner to address systemic contradictions within neoliberal capitalism. Unprecedented fiscal and monetary interventions were strategic tools to stabilize the economy and prevent a deeper collapse of financial markets. The lockdowns, framed as public health necessities, effectively suspended economic activity in ways that allowed capital to regroup and restructure. This included consolidating corporate power, e.g., through increased reliance on digital platforms, and creating conditions for new rounds of capital investment post-crisis, facilitated by a convenient debt crisis and World Bank loans with pro-neoliberal strings attached conditionalities. The framing of COVID-19 as a health crisis obscured its role in facilitating economic restructuring under the guise of emergency management. That comes from the article, Circling the Drain, UK Crisis, What Crisis? COVID crisis is a policy mechanism to impose a restructuring of global economy, by Colin Todd Hunter, posted January 22nd. When I saw Larry Ellison, Netanyahu's right-hand man with Gaza blood up to his elbows, the very men who, along with Peter Thiel, has led the battle to take over the entire military and intelligence system through the control of data clouds and command control systems up there at the White House with Elon Musk's buddy at OpenAI, Sam Altman, and SoftBank's CEO, Son Masayoshi. I could feel that the Destroyer has been selected, and the Destroyer is AI this time. But Larry Ellison, the man who merged U.S. and Israeli intelligence into a single monster and is trying to take over the world, went even further. Egged on by Trump, he told us that we will all be subject to a blood test in the future to determine if we have cancer, and that if the AI test of your blood finds any cancer cells, which we have no way of knowing whether it is true or not, that we will be given, customized by AI, cancer vaccines. Ellison did not say it would be mandatory, but it sounded like it will be. Ellison also stated that Oracle has already begun construction for 10 data centers in Texas, each 500,000 square feet for Stargate, and the total will be 20, and they will control massive amounts of data, starting with all medical records for everyone in the world. That comes from the article. Trump calls for exit of WHO and launches global vaccine regime administered by AI, by Emmanuel Pastriche, posted January 22nd, originally published on Fear No Evil. With the U.S. exiting WHO, this may now all change. Other countries, which would not have dared taking the lead in abandoning WHO, may now have the courage to follow the master. Except for Germany, given the absurd and extremely vigorous life and economy-destroying COVID mandates, the government has already launched a desperate call for Mr. Trump to reconsider. It is highly doubtful that he will. If WHO collapses or is disgraced, the entire house of cards on which this lie of all lies was built falls apart, and many of the German tyrants imposing the rules, well aware that they were not justified, may face criminal charges. That comes from the article, President Trump Mandates Exiting the World Health Organization, by Peter Koenig, posted January 22nd. NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte seems to have been tempted, albeit briefly, by this notion of the poet-politician or the politician-poet. While his speech at the Concert Nobel in Brussels last December can never qualify for any decent anthology of poetry, it illuminates his and NATO's position on ongoing war in Ukraine. Rutte is a martial type keen to advance the rule of the gun in the service of the alliance. The result is the evil of banality delivered in poesy. A chief function of NATO's public relations efforts lies in justifying its own existence. That comes from the article, Pity the Poesy, Mark Rutte, NATO, and Spending for War, by Dr. Binoy Kampmark, posted January 22nd. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. We are going to take a close look at the economic plan of President Donald Trump with the assistance of Global Research contributor Rodrigue Tremblay. Professor Rodrigue Tremblay is based in Quebec. He's an international economist and the author of the book about morals, The Code for Global Ethics, 10 Humanist Principles, of the book about geopolitics, The New American Empire, and of the recent book in French, La Régression Tranquille du Québec, 1980 to 2018. He holds a PhD in international finance from Stanford University. He is a research associate of the Center for Research on Globalization. Professor Tremblay, it is a pleasure to have you back on the Global Research News Hour, and especially at such a dramatic time in Canadian politics. Welcome.
Yes, I'm happy to talk to you.
So first of all, when you heard him talking about drilling more oil and gas and exporting it as if, you know, drill, baby, drill, as if it's only a commitment to climate change that restricts the U.S. from doing that right now. In a show that we did several years ago, even with hydraulic fracturing, the best reserves have been used up and the decline should be coming soon if it hasn't happened yet. So even if the U.S. mined these resources in every place they could get their hands on, I mean, could you really see that that strategy is going to make a difference?
Well, you have to remember that Europe used to import a lot of natural gas from Russia, and the pipeline, the Nord Stream pipeline from Russia to Germany was blew up in 2022, and therefore the U.S. now exports a lot of natural gas towards Europe. So it's a very profitable trade that the United States has developed with Europe, and therefore, besides domestic demand for gas and oil, but it's natural that the U.S. Would need to have new sources of supply for gas and oil. And Canada, of course, is one of their main supplier of gas and oil and electricity also, because this is the main sector of import-export between Canada and the United States.
Let's talk about the tariffs. In an article that you wrote less than 2 weeks ago, entitled "The Trump Administration's Agenda and the Likely Economic and Financial Consequences," you mentioned the same strategy of tariffs as it played out in the 1930s. I mean, it became an international trade war. And I mean, could you explain to our listeners what exactly is going on that makes this tariff maneuver actually self-defeating for the U.S.?
Well, historically, the main example that we have where trade war was introduced in the world economy was in 1930. There has been a great financial crash in October 1929, and the Herbert Hoover administration in 1930, after a few months after the crash, implemented a 20% tariff on their imports from everywhere. As a matter of fact, during the campaign, Mr. Trump said that he was planning to raise a 10% tariff on anything that the United States was importing. This has been suspended, I understand, especially towards China. In the 1930s, that tariff made the depression deeper because many countries reacted to the American tariffs by imposing their own tariffs. Therefore, international trade as a whole collapsed, and this brought a drop of production, a lot of recession in many countries, and this prolonged and made it deeper, the Great Depression of 1929 to 1939. Then when the war started in 1939 to 1945, there was a rebound, but the stock market in the United States, which had reached a top in 1929, only got back to the same level 25 years later, in 1954. So therefore, these things can last a long time when you set them in motion.
Well, I think that, there are some major differences between that era and the current one, right? I mean, for example, there's been a lot of deindustrialization of the U.S. economy, outsourcing to other countries, the financialization. I mean, more and more dependent on things like real estate, insurance, derivatives, and so on, whereas the actual production is abroad. And that's something that we don't really think about when we're thinking about trade, across borders. So could you maybe talk about the kinds of differences those dynamics make in terms of that kind of recession that happened in the 1930s? Will it make it worse than that, or is it mitigate it in some way?
Well, the national economies now are much more integrated, interdependent today than they were in the 1920s or 1930s. After World War II, different institutions were created to promote international trade and international capital movements, because economic relationships between countries do not imply only the trade of goods and services, but also capital movements. And the balance of payment of a country is composed mainly of capital movements and trade movements. And they have to balance, in a sense. And the United States now has a privileged position because it has its own currency, the dollar, the U.S. dollar, used by other countries. 60% of the reserves of central banks around the world are in U.S. dollars. And 50% of all the trades and financial transactions around the world are in U.S. dollars. This is the privileged situation in the United States, because when it has a fiscal deficit, for example, as it has now, the U.S. government has a huge $3 trillion deficit a year. This is financed partly to a large extent by other countries. And that allows the United States to have, for example, 800 military bases all around the world that cost a lot of money. And many other countries are contributing in the financing of that expansion around the world. Therefore, the United States economy is very much involved in the world, much more than in 1930s. And therefore, if you want to isolate the United States economically, this will be a disaster for the United States, but it will be a disaster also for the world, for the world economy, and this could precipitate a new economic depression. So this is not a minor question. This is a major question. But you have to remember that Mr. Trump, President Trump, sometimes will say something as a negotiating tactic, making threats in order to get concessions. And this is, I think, probably the main objective now is to renegotiate a lot of trade agreements that exist between the United States and other countries. Mind you, between the United States and Canada and Mexico, there has been a new negotiation, a new treaty negotiated in 2019, only 5 years ago. And this is due to be renegotiated next year in 2026. What President Trump would like to do, and his advisors, they would like to start a new renegotiation right now, not wait 1 year. And that's why he just mentioned that between now and February the first, he will try to persuade Canada, the Canadian government, and the Mexican government to start renegotiating that treaty. And he will do the same thing with China and other countries and Europe also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, just to on that point, because I mean, I think you're sort of suggesting a lot of his moves, as dictated already, are kind of like faking one way, but the real mess is going to be renegotiating trade all over the world. But I mean, if they were to, for example, go taking on the BRICS countries, Russia, China, the use of the dollar, as you mentioned, I mean, the use of the U.S. dollar, 60% of the reserves and so on, that when you take tariffs against a BRIC country, like even though they're, arranging their financial assets, as an alternative, I'm wondering, would the opposite effect, would it not have the opposite effect of punishing them? I mean, does it come back in some way? I mean, how does that work?
Well, the relationship between the United States and the BRICS country, from Brazil, Russia, China, South Africa, is related to the use of the US dollars because of the sanctions that the United States government has been applying on countries using financial and trade sanctions. To try to force them to follow a U.S. Rule or forest interest. This is already in the making. Now the BRICS countries are negotiating using a new unit of financial monetary transaction for monetary transaction, trade transaction, and capital transaction. Mr. Trump, during the campaign, mentioned that he will raise 100% tariffs against the BRICS. This will just hurry the breakdown of the financial, monetary, international financial system based on the US dollars. Since 1971, the US dollar is not backed by gold in any way. Before 1971, during the Nixon administration, the US dollar was converted into gold for at least central banks. Now it's purely a fiduciary currency. I don't think this can be stopped. It's too far ahead now with the war in Ukraine between Russia and the threat of the United States imposed on China regarding Taiwan and all that. That conflict, I think, cannot be solved purely with monetary or financial matters. The main conflict now is between within the allies, within NATO. Canada is part of NATO. Europe, most of Europe, is part of NATO, and the United States will lie. The Trump administration would like to renegotiate trade because Mr. Trump does not believe in free trade, as Senator, some senator have said that he wants bargain or negotiated trade. So we are faced with that. I don't think we should panic unduly, though. I think things will fall on their good side in the coming weeks and months, but we could expect some pressure on Canada on some trades, for example, agricultural products. Mind you, if we Canada has a surplus trade surplus with the United States. But if we subtract the energy trade between Canada and the United States, which is about $166 billion a year, Canada has a deficit on the other side of the trade equation. Therefore, I think we should have more meetings between officials from the Canadian government and the U.S. government to discuss the details of what's going on. the two main important trade sectors between the two countries are first energy, where the United States import a lot of oil, gas, and electricity. New York City is using Quebec electricity for its own needs. And the other is the Ottawa Pact, which was signed between Canada and the United States in 1964. And the trade is about balance between the U.S. and Canada, $85 or $84 billion each way. Some companies bring cars from Canada to the U.S., and some cars are coming from the U.S. to Canada. It's pretty much balanced. And the rest is important, but not as important as these two sectors. So the economies of the United States and Canada are very integrated, and it would be crazy to try to cut these links. Trade wars, every country loses in trade wars, and the 1930s show that very clearly.
In your expert opinion, I mean, given the way things are laid out now and the direction they're going, where do you think the U.S. and the world is headed to over the next 4 years? I mean, will it be a repeat of the 1930s and winding up in another world war?
Well, nobody knows, of course, because Mr. Trump is more a case of psychiatry than economics. He does a lot of things for his own posture, political posture in the United States. Some psychiatrists have written books. Psychologists also have written books about Mr. Trump, his character, who has symptoms of somebody who is a psychopath, and he's impulsive, he has no remorse, he's narcissistic, and all that. We hope that his cabinet will be more down to earth and will try to advise him correctly. Besides, the U.S. System of check and balances will have to be tested. Will the Senate, especially, and they have begun, the Senate has begun approving or disapproving his recommendation to cabinet. Is this system going to still work? Donald Trump doesn't like too much the U.S. Constitution, but he cannot write it alone and discard it. So this is an American problem more than an international problem within the United States. Unfortunately, the Biden administration was not very productive in putting its case during the election. Therefore, the result was 51% for the Republicans and 49%, about 48% for the Democrats. There's a big political problem within the United States now, and this will have to be solved or contained in the next 4 years while Mr. Trump is in power.
Professor Tremblay, fascinating discussion. We'll keep our eyes peeled over the next few days until the mighty tariff lever is pulled or not. Best of luck to you in the coming year.
Thank you very much. Prepare for the worst and hope for the best.
Okay. We were joined by Professor Rodrigue Tremblay, international economist, writer, and a research associate with the Center for Research on Globalization.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. One man had written an article over a month and a half ago related to what Trump's
picks for cabinet had to say about his likely policy agenda, and by all external purposes, it's not about peace. Timothy Alexander Guzman is an independent researcher and writer with a focus on political, economic, media, and historical spheres. He has been published at globalresearch.ca, The Progressive Mind, and a number of other alternative news sites. He runs the alternative media site Silent Crow News. Mr. Guzman, it's nice to finally have you on the Global Research News Hour. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael. It's finally great to be with you.
Yeah, well, why don't we just start off by talking about the cabinet positions, and I guess the most glaring for me right now is Marco Rubio, because he's already got a reputation of not, I mean, he's a Cuban exile, you know, somebody whose family left just in the time that Castro was waging his revolution, so he's on the wrong side of that one, and he's also been hostile towards Venezuela. And he's also got a strange predilection for liking Israel, the Israeli flag alongside the American flag outside of his office. Could you tell us a little bit more about what Marco Rubio would mean as Secretary of State?
Well, it'll definitely mean he'll be more for interventions in Latin America, especially Venezuela, Nicaragua. They've recently just took off Cuba. They put Cuba back on the terrorist list, which Biden removed in his last days, which, you know, kind of looks like, you know, it was, everyone knew that the Trump regime was going to remove, put Cuba back on the terrorist watch list.
Yeah, I figured that, just sort of to interrupt, but I mean, Biden had just signed that executive order just about a week beforehand, right? So
that's correct. Yes. Yes. And remember, Marco Rubio comes from the Cuban elite in Miami. And he's a, you know, an absolute war hawk. I mean, he's pro-Israel, anti-China, anti-Russia. He's voted for all wars, even ones that Democrats started, you know, including the one with Libya. When they invaded, when they overthrew Muammar Gaddafi, he voted for that under the, you know, U.S. NATO invasion of Libya that destroyed that country. He's a war. He's definitely anti-China. If you saw his confirmation hearings, I mean, he was, you know, mostly about China, but also about Israel, right? You know, Marco Rubio is a war hawk neocon. I mean, he's a prime cabinet member in one of the hawkish, you know, I think they're all hawkish, to be honest with you, Michael, but, you know, Rubio is up there in terms of, you know, interventions against all these Latin American nations, you know, and I think, to be honest with you, if Evo Morales of Bolivia, you know, gets reelected or whatever, I mean, they'll try to overthrow him again, which Trump's first term in office, you know, when they overthrew Evo Morales, you know, it was U.S. backed, and Donald Trump congratulated that new government. So Marco Rubio is an absolute neocon, and he's supported by AIPAC as well. He gets a lot of money from AIPAC, like many members of Trump's cabinet.
Wow. So, I mean, one thing that it's quite possible that they would go, as you said, into Bolivia and Venezuela, like militarily, right?
I think they're first going to do an intervention. I don't think Trump wants a war, you know, directly, you know, with Venezuela, you know, now. I think they're going to focus more on the Panama Canal, which I think is insane. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, I was in Panama, you know, with my family a couple of years ago. And, you know, we visited the Panama Canal, you know, we did the tourist thing. And then we were all around Panama, and there was no Chinese troops, you know, like Trump is claiming. There was no, military Chinese people, you know, patrolling the waterways or anything like that, that Trump is claiming. So, you know, I think they're going to focus more on trying to seize the Panama Canal and try to get it under U.S. control. And that's actually to stop the China's Brick and Road Initiative. You know, I think they, in a way, they want to stop, you know, China's influence in Latin America. So, you know, the Panamanians were really upset with this, you know, with Trump announcing that they're going to seize the Panama Canal. There was already protests in the streets. So this is going to be very dangerous. I think it's going to be dangerous for two regions under Marco Rubio. I think it's going to be dangerous for Latin America, and I think it's going to be extremely dangerous for the Middle East. No question about that.
Well, where does Mike Waltz fit into this? Because he's going to be the national security advisor. He's also very much hawk leaning, right?
Oh, absolutely. Because Mike Waltz is, and you know, he's going to be, you know, elbow to elbow with Marco Rubio singing Kumbaya, you know, because they both of them are, he's another neocon war hawk. He's definitely anti-China, and he's also anti-Russia. So, you know, he has spoken out before. I actually have a quote from him, and I'm going to read to you, if that's okay.
Sure.
His quote is, let me get it here, says, give me 1 second, and I saved it just for you. So the administration, give me 1 second. I'm so sorry.
No, that's okay.
There we go. Okay. I think a second Trump term will be energy policy. And the fact is that sanctions haven't been enforced on Russia. They're selling more oil and gas through China and India than they ever did even before the war. Their war machine is flush with cash. President Trump is, I think, going to get him to the table very quickly, because if he enforces those sanctions, the old adage, Russia is a little more than a gas station with nukes, absolutely holds true. And this was Mike Waltz talking to Fox News. He was on Fox News, and they were asking him about, you know, what he thinks about Russia. So he's absolutely very hawkish on both of the major powers. So I think Mike Waltz is not, you know, he's definitely a war hawk. And, you know, you don't get into the what it seems that you don't get into the Trump White House, you know, not being a war hawk. And that's what it seems with all of his picks.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Pete Hegseth as the Secretary of Defense pick, he is a wow. I don't know. I mean, this guy seems to be bordering on insane or something in terms of his, you know, I mean, to talk about his role on Israel and on the war hawk fence generally.
Yeah, well, he's a self-admitted Christian Zionist. Mm-hmm. So he's absolutely pro-Israel. So I think him as a, you know, in the Trump regime, he's going to be very hawkish on all these, on everyone in the Middle East. And he's, you know, he's going to be pro-Israel. I mean, he's going to be giving them, you know, he's going to want more funding for Israeli weapons, you know, and he's going to, you know, want most likely to advance U.S. agenda in Israel. And who knows, with a guy like Pete Hegseth, he's probably going to want U.S. troops on the ground in Israel to help Israel. So that's what I believe. I think that, you know, Pete Hegseth is a very dangerous individual. If you've seen any of his when he was on Fox News and his hawkish stance on everything, you mm-hmm. know, from Venezuela to Russia, to China, you know, to Hamas and Hezbollah and Iran, you know, all of these guys, you know, especially Pete Hegseth, you know, they're for war. So I mm-hmm. think it's going to be a very dangerous time.
Yeah, well, we want to go through some of the other things. We've got Elise Stefanik as U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Kristi Noem or Neem as a Secretary of Homeland Security, Pam Bondi as the Attorney General, and one thing they definitely all have in common is, again, these you know, protecting Israel, you know, at all costs, even to the extent of wanting to deport those people who they say are pro-Hamas, as opposed to, you know, anti-genocide, or maybe misinterpreting the two things, and that kind of is pushing them, you know, it basically pushes away the actual constitutional rights of your fellow Americans, if I understand that.
That's correct. Pam Bondi wants to deport people
as Attorney General.
as Attorney General, she wants to deport people for criticizing Israel. And Christine Noem, she's another Christian Zionist as well. She was the former governor of South Dakota, who attended AIPAC meetings, and you know, she's very she's an extreme Christian Zionist. Mm-hmm. She's a very hawkish when it comes to Israel, right? I mean, she's sort of like a another the other guy that's he's the U.S. ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee. Mm-hmm. Now, this guy is another lunatic, and I'm sorry to say, he's absolutely insane. This guy, he belittles Palestinians to the point where he makes them subhuman, you know. So, to me, I think Mike Huckabee, Christine Noem, Pam Bundy. I mean, these people are tailor made, and they were selected by AIPAC to join the Trump's administration. Mm-hmm. So they were all of these people are highly supported, especially Elise Stefanik. She's going to be the UN ambassador to the UN, and she's going to be another Nikki Haley, who is yes. You know, and they both on the same page. Mm-hmm. And even the lady that used to be under the Obama administration, from you remember the lady with the red hair, I forgot her name. She used to be under the Obama
administration. Yeah, I know what you mean. Paseko or something.
Something like that. Yeah, she was another, you know, pro-Israel. You know, she voted everything in favor of Israel when she was at the UN, and the same thing as Nikki Haley. You know, so Elise Stefanik is just following in the same path. They just, you know, these people were selected by AIPAC, and they're you know, no doubt warmongers, and they'll do anything for Israel.
Yeah, I just maybe one more point. I on the cabinet. I mean, John Ratcliffe is the director now, the director of Central Intelligence, and Tulsi Gabbard, who many people believe to be anti-war, is the director of National Intelligence. I mean, what are the points about those two that you would underline as, you know, caution?
Well, John Ratcliffe is the same as Mike Waltz. I mean, they have the same ideology. Mm. He's definitely pro-Israel. He's anti-China. I think one of his main adversaries that he fears is China. Mm-hmm. That's one of his main enemies that he wants to focus on. But, you know, then again, you know, these people are all going to, you know, focus on Iran. Ratcliffe is a, you know, pro-Israel supporter. He's anti-Russia, anti-China as well. And Tulsi Gabbard is interesting, right? I mean, you remember when she was talking about how, she visited Bashar al-Assad in Syria, and, you know, she was investigating the chemical weapons attack, you know, and she wanted to end the war in Syria. But then again, when it came to Israel and the attack, you know, after October 7th, she changed the tune and, you know, we got to protect Israel. You know, it's Hamas. Hamas is a terrorist organization, and I fought against terrorism when I was in the army and so forth. So Tulsi Gabbard is a mixed bag. You know, she's you know, peace on one side, but when it comes to Israel on the other, you know, she's technically pro-Israel. And she attended the AIPAC meetings, right? She received funding when she was a congressperson. From Israel, from AIPAC, and she, you know, anything that comes with Israel, you know, Michael, unfortunately, every single one of these cabinet members is pro-Israel. Israel has a hold on U.S. Congress. No question about that. Every single one of them. And especially Trump. Trump, you know, is worried about his legacy, right? He wants a statue in Tel Aviv somewhere saying that he saved Israel. You know, that's Trump's, plan. He wants to be his legacy to remember as the man who saved Israel, right? And it's no different, by the way, from Joe Biden. Remember when Joe Biden said, you know, I don't believe you have to be a Jewish person to be a Zionist. I am a Zionist, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, all of these people are all the same. Israel has a stronghold on on the U.S. Congress and you know, all the senators and all the Congress people. I mean, they have all of these people in their pockets, right? And on top of that, a lot of these people, you know, including Pete Hegseth and Mike Waltz and Huckabee and all of them, they still want the U.S. to be the prime superpower in the world. You know, it's still following what the Bush neocons, the project for the new American century, right? They want to rule the world. And that's what these people want. And that's what Trump wants. Trump wants to be number one. He wants to be the sole empire that controls everything around the planet. I mean, this man wants to change the name from the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America. Can you imagine that? I mean, people voted for Donald Trump because they wanted lower grocery prices. You know, everything's inflationary, everything's expensive. The first order of business, he wants to change the name of the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America. Now, you know, things like that, you know, tells you that, you know, he's a follower of the Monroe Doctrine, right? They should call it, you know, as they say, the Donroe Doctrine, right? He wants to take over Canada. You know, he wants Canada to be a 51st state, which will never happen. You know, that'll be impossible, mm-hmm. you know, because, you know, and he wants to take over Greenland. But going back to the whole thing of making Canada the 51st state, that cannot possibly happen because you will have to change, the U.S. will have to change its constitution. You know, you will have to give up some senators and probably, you know, Congress people in certain states. And you know what happens when you lose senators and Congress people, you lose funding for education, infrastructure, and all that type of stuff. So you will have to make room for Canadians, you know, for Canadian senators and Congress people. You know, and that would create chaos within the Constitution and the way the U.S. operates. So that ain't going to happen. I think he's just saber rattling.
Yeah, well, let's not forget that there would be resistance within the target country to begin with. Yeah. If you just joined us, you're listening to the Global Research News Hour. My name is Michael Welch, and my guest right now is Timothy Alexander Guzman, who's a writer and a researcher and founder of Silent Crow News. Well, maybe we'll move away from the cabinet and now look at, because, I mean, this cabinet seems like it's beyond the neocons of the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration. I mean, they seem more like a bunch of rabid animals that are being held back with chains, waiting to unleash themselves. But I think that another thing you have to look at is who is funding this, because as they say, I mean, even where Donald Trump and his ego is concerned, you know, he who pays the piper calls the tune. And you had a whole bunch of billionaires this time, unprecedented, 13 billionaires among the cabinet posts. Elon Musk, of course, who's a major figure, Mark Zuckerberg and Jeff Bezos, just a few examples. What do you think that degree of influence and that degree of visibility is going to tell you? It puts aside the pretense of concern for the plight of the common man over the bosses? That's not the real focus here. I mean, what can you add to that? What more might it mean in terms of actual policies affecting ordinary working class people?
I think they want to control the narrative, first and foremost, right? That's why Trump, Biden had banned TikTok, right? Mm-hmm. The whole thing with TikTok. So now Trump wants the U.S. to control 50% of TikTok, from what I understood. And it's about controlling the narrative, right? I mean, Mark Zuckerberg said, oh, now I'm not going to have censorship, you know, but they are going to have censorship somehow, some way, especially if it's, you know, critical of Israel. So it's about controlling the narrative at one point. And Elon Musk, you know, has his own plans, you know, to expand his, you know, his empire, you know, especially with things like Starlink and his space exploration, and they're going to Mars, and, you know, and he's promising people that, you know, one day you're going to go to Mars, which none of us are going to go to Mars, you know, and I don't think any of us want to go to Mars, to be honest with you. There's nothing up there. But, you know, I think there's going to be a more or less a controlling the narrative on, you know, with these online platforms, and these tech companies became very powerful, you know, especially Facebook, you know, when it first came out, it was a very powerful platform to voice your opinion. And then, you know, they, you know, once COVID came out, you remember the whole thing with the pandemic, they were censoring, you know, many news stories, and they censored many alternative media websites and, you know, about opinions and facts about, you know, the vaccines. So I think it's going to be more or less a control of the narrative, you know, the narrative where what they don't want people to know. And you know, in relation to that, with all of these oligarchs, Trump was talking about that he wants to have education in the public schools to make, you know, about America, about America's greatness, right?
Yeah.
Right. So that, to me, that's saying, I want to control what the students learn. I don't want them to know about the true history, what happened to the indigenous peoples, what happens to Israel, or what happens to the Middle East or Latin America, right? So it's all about the narrative, I think, with all these oligarchs. And, you know, Jeff Bezos, you know, is another billionaire who you know, I guess wants to have his, you know, expand that, you know, Amazon, which, you know, I don't think he needs any more expanding. He's made, you know, billions. But that's what it is to me, a more a control of the narrative on these platforms. And these platforms became more powerful than the mainstream media, as you know, Michael, right? I mean, they get more viewers than Fox News and CNN and MSNBC and even Newsmax, right? So they, I think that's what it's all going to be about, you know, in the end.
Yeah. Well, you got to also consider, I mean, it's going to be, like you say, shaping the narrative, but you've also got to consider that, I mean, especially with the cabinet picks that you put together, it will actually legalize, in some sense, freedom of speech, you know, like the freedom to speak out against Israel. I mean, when you have a cabinet secretary who's actually an attorney general who's actually threatening to deport people who have the wrong opinion, you know, freedom of speech doesn't just mean, you know, it also means freedom of the speech that you don't like. But that's not going to be applying here anymore. So, I mean, this is ultimately a threat to civil liberties, I believe.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And
It's a total contradiction.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, you right now, they're issuing these ICE officers to go out and, you know, as I mentioned, you know, they're stopping and deploying illegal migrants. And I mean, that's happening as we speak. When you consider that the economy is lagging a bit, inflation is up and so on, I mean, you've got two basic approaches. You could, as in the 1930s, get the New Deal going, as, you know, something like that, with the, you know, emphasizing employment and so on, or go to war, a world war. And that's ultimately what they decided. I guess with all these billionaires in the pike, I'm wondering, you know, which option this government, the Trump government, is likely to go. I mean, because there are four major fronts of battle: China, Taiwan, Ukraine, Russia, Israel, Iran, and U.S. Latin America. So even if triggered by an accident, is there any other alternative you can see this scenario, given the monetary players and the cabinet?
Sorry to be pessimistic, Michael, but I think there's going to be war. It's like the, you know, one guy I listen to occasionally is Gerald Celente, and he says this famous quote: "When all else fails, they take you to war." And I think since the U.S. economy is slowly collapsing, and all these deals that Trump is talking about he wants to make, you know, half of these deals are going to fail. You know, he's not going to end the war between Russia and Ukraine. He just threatened them. I don't know if you saw the news yesterday that, you know, he's going to slap tariffs, that he's going to, you know, continue the sanctions, and that we could do it the easy way or could do it the hard way, in his last tweet on Truth Social. So, you know, in that aspect, you know, I think that war is going to continue. You know, they're going to get to the table. You know, he said he was going to end the war in 24 hours. Now it's 100 days. Then it's going to stretch out to 6 months, and then it's going to stretch out to 2 years, right? It's going to keep going. So, and then the thing with Iran, Actually, a couple of days ago, a new video just came out with Eric Prince. He was the former CEO of Blackwater. You remember him,
Yes.
Michael?
Yep.
Right. So he just they just there's a video on YouTube, and I implore your viewers and listeners to watch this video. It's called Iran's Next Target, Panama Canal, right? And he's talking about that Iran is eyeing the Panama Canal for some reason, right? They want to, control the Panama Canal and target the U.S. interest. With these type of people talking about war and about invasions and so forth, I'm very pessimistic. I think there's going to be a world war with Donald Trump and his peace through strength. And I mean, when you insult Russia and saying that we're going to do it the easy way or the hard way, if not, if you don't do what we say, we're going to give you tariffs and sanctions. And and the thing is, how much more can you sanction Russia? Right? I think they're one of the most sanctioned countries in the world. And you know what? Russia's economy is not doing too bad. It's doing okay, right? I mean, it's not collapsing in any way, but it's doing okay. It's moving along. They're making, they partnered up with China. They doing business with India. The BRICS nations, right? The BRICS nations is rising. And Trump said any country that deals with BRICS, they're going to somehow get sanctioned or tariffs, or they're going to pay a price for dealing with BRICS, right? Those type of threats to me is a call for war, right? So all of these people that's in his cabinet, they all get preparing for war, and that's the bottom line. I don't think I'm not optimistic about the America's future. I think it's an empire that's dying, and when an empire dies, when they start to die, you're going to see a lot of these wars, right? They're backed up against the wall, and once that happens, they're going to go after, they're going to start with the small countries that they know they can beat, like Panama, right? If the U.S. were to sh send U.S. Navy ships to Panama, what Panama can do? They don't really have a formidable military. Right, so they can do it with a country like that. But as we know, Michael, countries that fight back, America doesn't do too well. Right? Look what happened in Iraq. I've written about this before. Iraq and Afghanistan. These people fought. Yeah, these wars were 20 years, 20 20 years, and of fighting, and the U.S. really didn't accomplish anything in these countries. Sometimes I think that these wars that America starts and they know they're not going to win is not to win the wars. It's to continue the war for the military industrial complex so they could continue producing the weapons, continue producing the results of what they want in these countries, right? So I think that the next war, unfortunately, I think it's going to be against Iran. I think they're targeting Iran. There's no question about that.
Okay. Timothy Alexander Guzman, thank you so much for your analysis.
Thank you, Michael.
Timothy Alexander Guzman is a researcher and writer and writes for Silent Crow News.
That's our show for this week. Next week, we'll be exploring a series of false flags that erupted over the course of January. Don't miss it. You're listening to the Global Research NewsHour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation in the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.